Welcome to EAN Cast, your weekly source for education, research, and updates from the European Academy of Neurology.
Hello and welcome to EAN Cast Weekly Neurology. My name is Raphaël Bernavalnet. I'm a neurologist at Lausanne University Hospital, specializing in neuroimmunology. This month's topic is artificial intelligence in clinical neurology. And today, the episode, we will talk about AI demystified, what it is and what it isn't. I'm very honored to have as guests Professor Roland Vist and Dr. Monica Moroni. Professor Vist is professor of advanced neuroimaging at the University of Bern. He has an interest in AI in radiology, including analysis of stroke AI, MS lesion segmentation, brain tumor imaging, and epilepsy. Monica Moroni is a senior researcher at Data Science for Health Unit at Bruno Kessler Foundation in Trento. A work focuses on projects to integrate AI for predictive, preventive, and personalized medicine in Parkinson's disease and multiple sclerosis, as well on machine learning models that can predict falls in Parkinson's patients. And today, we'd like to answer to us very simple questions. What should a neurologist actually know about AI and how to use it? So maybe my first question will be to Monica. When we say AI in medicine, what we actually talking about? Can you explain to us and to a colleague who hasn't taken any computer science course?
Yes, sure. So I would say that the term AI in medicine is like an umbrella term that includes many different things. So from a technical point of view, we talk of AI in medicine every time we have a system or a solution that has learned autonomously some patterns or structure from data and uses these patterns to make sense of other information. In other words, an AI system has learned and is able to provide a suggestion or support without being explicitly told step-by-step instructions on how to do that. From the practical point of view, if we want to think at some examples, AI in medicine can refer to many different things. For example, we can have support tools that assist in technical tasks that can be long notes, summarization, but also, for example, images or volume segmentation. We can have diagnostic or prognostic models that give support to make some diagnosis based on the data that we have, on the information that we have, or that do prediction of risk or progression of some disease. All of these are just some examples of implementations of AI in medicine.
Okay, thank you so much. And maybe a more specific question to you, Roland. Do you think how this MRI software, can you explain to us how all this segmentation that Monica mentioned, how it works? And sometimes we have the impression that it could be a black box. How do you, it really works? What is the math behind and the system behind?
Yeah, so thank you, Monica, first, because you have already elaborated on the topic, and it's indeed a great question, because I think we need to ask two different questions. The first is what is happening in the machine, and then what is happening thereafter, because there are two major domains at the moment where AI is implemented, and one of the key applications currently is acceleration of imaging. That means making techniques faster in order to have an earlier diagnosis, but also to make it happen that more patients can be examined. And there we simply have AI tools that try to solve a problem to generate a high-resolution image from low-resolution input. There are several technologies. Don't want to go too much into details there, but what is done usually is there is a sparse sampling, because not all the data points in an image, they contain information that is relevant. And this one is reconstructed. And this brings us, of course, the opportunity that we can accelerate these images faster, but it also generates some challenges. And these challenges, they are related to artifacts, because we know that artifacts get pronounced, because by these filtering and reconstruction techniques, artifacts that are already in the image, they are suddenly visible. That means we need to have some control techniques that enable us to be sure that these added informations, so-called informations, are really artifacts or not. So this is one of the challenges that we currently face. The other one, and this has been nicely elaborated already by Monica, that is the data post-processing. It's a completely different topic because this is mainly the domain of learning imaging features in a data set that have been trained on large, either annotated or not annotated data sets. And you have mentioned already, Monica, the decision support tool. So they give us some advice how we can read these images. For example, if there is a lesion that is spotted or not, there are other technologies that are called opportunistic screening techniques. So they are usually running in the baseline in order to inform the radiologist or also the clinician if there is a certain abnormality in the images, and this can then be controlled by the reader. And the third and also very important domain that is quantitative imaging. So we get information, like for example, for volumetry of MS lesions, we get information about brain volumetry, and this helps us not only, let's say, to make a pre-assumption about a certain diagnosis based on an atrophy pattern, it also shows us how a disease evolves over time. So overall, I think there are many very interesting applications that are already used in the clinics.
Okay, but maybe following on that, we sometimes have the impression that we see very fancy papers on AI and it's used in neurology, but sometimes we have the impression that it's not implemented in the daily practice. So maybe could you comment on that?
Yes, I love this topic because many people are all the time talking about, well, AI helps us to make, let's say, procedures faster or maybe also to make the work easier. But I think this is not a key element. AI, we should understand AI as a complementary reader. And maybe we should get back a bit into how we humans usually reason, because we are under daily pressure. We have to analyze many data all the time. So on average, for every slice in an image, a radiologist has roughly 1 to 2 seconds. So what do? We use heuristic decision-making. That is, we are creating shortcuts. We profit from what we have learned in the past, but we do not go completely into analytical thinking processes anymore. All of you do that. If you read a newspaper in the moment, in the morning, and you are in hurry, then you will just read the paper in part and you will understand what is the content. And this is what we usually do in our daily work. And only if you have some kind of divergence in the analytics or the outcome, we activate our complex analytic and systematic thinking system. And there I see the main role for AI. It's just like a complementary second reader that provides us with information and helps us to prevent overlooking or, let's say, not spotting something that may be either obscured or somewhere at the end of the images, at the borders of the images. So the key element and the key added value is definitely this kind of complementary reading as a second reader in the round.
But just to precise, for instance, at the Inter-Spital, do you have some of these tools that are already implemented?
Yes. So thank you for that question. We are really pretty much advanced. We have a platform system where we have integrated 14 different AI systems that are running in the back. So that means the human reader does not need to activate these AI tools. We have structured and systematically implemented this kind of so-called relevancy rules. So it's automatic detected which protocol needs which kind of AI processing to be solved. Then this is automatically sent into clouds. The data are analyzed in an anonymized way in the clouds. They are sent back. Then this data and this post-processed data, they appear in a reading window to the reader, and then there is the human decision making. So you have to accept or to reject the results of this post-processing in order if you determine if this is a proper or an improper decision making. But everything is running in the back. It's fully automated, and we are currently processing roughly 3,000 AI tasks per month.
Okay, that's really, really great. Maybe stepping back from neuroradiology, and maybe a question for you, Monica, where do you see that AI could be applicable to clinical neurology. Maybe, I don't know, in wearable EEG reading or anything else. Where do you see maybe now the most promising application of AI?
Yeah, thank you. This is a very good question. So I would say that imaging is probably the field that is more mature. So we already have implemented solutions of AI. Another very promising field, I think, are like wearables and sensors, both for the processing of the data and also because of the amount of data that we have available with these tools. So with AI, we could think of like a continuous monitoring that is feasible in terms of resources. And this is like going to open like new avenues also for the monitoring of disease or of patients. So I would say that wearable and sensor are promising data types for AI. Regarding other data types, and also I would say the integration of different modalities, I think there is still some work to be done in the research settings before of the clinical application, because the results that we have now in research are still not so stable. So in order to implement them in clinical practice, we probably need a bit more of work, of robustness. But nevertheless, I think it's fundamental also in these more research settings to involve clinicians in the development of AI tools. So in order to be sure that what we are developing as models, as type of data integration, is something that could be meaningful in the clinics and in hospitals.
Okay, but from what I hear on your side, it's still that it's at a research step and not really implemented. And but maybe where do you see, I would be interested that if both of you can comment on where do you see the limitation in neurologists using that tool on everyday practice?
So if I may start, I think the key element, and that's what I tried to touch previously, is really the level of standardization. You need to develop concepts that clearly standardize all your crossover. It needs to be noted which kind of data shall be fed into the algorithm, how the data are composed, and how the whole line of processing is described. It's not enough that you have a tool, you can fill it somewhere. If the computer is in another room, nobody will use this tool. It needs to be there where the people are doing their work, they're reporting their analytics. It means you need to provide access to this system. You need also to secure that the output of these results is available to the distinct reader, so without having extra efforts and extra tasks to do. And then, of course, and this is the key element, it needs to be monitored. The quality needs to be monitored. There needs to be a quality assurance and governance process in place so that everybody knows if he uses this kind of tools, that's the way how he can interpret them. There are, for example, we also hand out certain interpretation guidelines to our residents, how they should deal with the results that are produced by the AI, so that we really have a structured and complete reporting standardization.
Yes, I totally agree. And I would also add that another aspect that should be, to which we should pay attention, is the way people are going to use these tools. So regarding the output of the tools, we should be sure that it's suitable for the application. I try to explain better. So we don't want that the support that is given, for example, by a decision support system is too effective in convincing people. So it should be something that is used by clinicians to be integrated into their clinical reasoning. So the way we present the result is going to affect the way this integration is working, and it's something that is crucial then in the usability and also in the fairness and proper use of the tools. And this is double side, so both in terms of development of the tool and the solution, and also in terms of education of people and the users to the interpretation of the tool. So that's also something that should be key in this introduction and the use of AI in medicine. So how we present the results of the of our tools and to teach users how to interpret the tools and to teach them where they should pay more or less attention.
Okay, thank you so much. And maybe along with your point, Monica, I know you work with wearables also, and do you think that patients will agree to use these new tools? Because neurologists is one side, but also patients is the other one.
Yeah, that's also a good question. So I think that if the advantages that have been evident, there should be, so there will be no strong opposition to the use of these tools. We should also think in terms of fairness and possibility of using these tools with some patients, all of the patients. So it's a complex framework, but so results in the research settings are promising. So I would say that if we find a way to ensure that they are integrated into the workflow and they can be used safely also from a fairness and regulatory framework, I think that the patients will not make a problem for using them.
Okay, thank you so much. And maybe regarding the limitation, we spoke about the gap between research and the clinic, but maybe one other gap would be how we neurologists understand what is behind these tools. And I know we will have another episode on the black box question, but I'd like still to touch it briefly and ask you both, what do we do if neurologists have difficulty to understand why the AI suggested this or something else? Maybe Roland, maybe you can comment on what you do when you describe that you have this feedback from AI in your neuroimaging tool. That would be interesting to say what's happening if you disagree with AI.
Yeah, I think there are two different aspects that we need to take into account. So if it really comes to a treatment decision, then interpretability is a key element. So that means we should understand how did the machine come to a decision. If it's just about, let's say, spotting a lesion or spotting an abnormality, then we still handle that through the principles of it's a term from a US legal. It's called vicarious liability. This is simply the principle that at the end, a human has to decide if something's true or not. The same for a senior consultant. If you have a resident, at the end, you need to judge if this information is reliable or not. And as I said, so there are certain things where it doesn't play a very important aspect. So if you have, for example, a large vessel occlusion detector, then and this detector alerts you that there is a vessel occlusion, you simply have to check it. You don't have to understand how a complex CNN has come to the decision. It's simply your task to verify it or to falsify it. If it gets into a therapy recommendation, then it's much more difficult, because then I think still, and we have seen these examples in the literature several times, that we can instead rely on something that is very simple, like a knowledge base or a rule-based implementation that is acting according to guidelines. You can nicely combine these things for spotting an abnormality. You can use a complex system that you must not understand in all details. But if it comes then to a treatment recommendation, then everything needs to be understood.
Okay, thank you so much. And maybe coming from that and along with that, we know that AI models are trained on population, and we know that there is a lot of differences between this population. How do you think that it induced bias, and maybe that could we really compare, for I don't know, between US and Europe, for instance, some type of software? I don't know if you can comment both on that.
Yes, happy too. So we learn a lot at the moment. I think something that is now, I think, common sense of agreement is that AI in the wild never behaves as AI in studies. So we have a lot of confounders related to data drifts, related to scanner differences. And I would even stress that it's not even difference between US and Europe, because we will have differences between Lausanne and Bern, for example, because if the scanners have a different design, they have a different field strength, they have different protocols, then we know that this may heavily impact on the quality. I can just give an example. For segmentations, for example, they may differ. If you switch between a 1.5 and a 7 Tesla scanner, then the differences may be as large as the difference between, let's say, a healthy 20 years old person and an elderly person suffering from severe Alzheimer's disease. So we need to be aware about that. And we come back again to this mantra, or to this, let's say, really key element: standardization is key. So if you do this kind of, let's say, analytics, then you should make sure that these patients are really examined at the same field strengths, in the best case, with the same scanners and with the same protocols. So I think what's really important is we need to know about data drifts. We need to know about the rejection rates. If they increase in your own center, then you should get alerted. You should get concerned. And the best thing to do, of course, is if you have more than one tool, to control for the deviation of another one, and if you have some converging results. This can be, of course, two different CE mark tools, but it's also possible, for example, if you just want to invest into one CE mark tool, that you have others that are publicly available in order to check your data. But you need to have some kind of quality insurance process that monitors post-deployment the efficacy of your system.
Yes, if I can further comment on this, from the technical perspective, what can be also done is like integrate these systems with some confidence scores or some hints that can be used by the user to know how much they can trust the result or this the support that they get. And in case the system already knows that the confidence is too low, or that the specific image or the specific sample that is seen in that moment is not similar to the training cohort, so to the data distribution where it performs well, in some cases it could be also useful if the system is not giving a solution, but just saying this data, I cannot comment, or I cannot give you support for this specific type of data. So that's something that could be or should be integrated into these systems. And as was said, the continuous monitoring is also fundamental. So after the deployment or during the deployment, the success rate or the usefulness of the specific tool in that specific solution should be checked and monitored.
Yeah, but sometimes maybe it's more difficult to, when you monitor, it's maybe more difficult for some questions, I don't know, especially for clinical diagnostic or something like that, to find a real gold standard or what should have been the answer.
Yeah, that's true. And in those cases, maybe already having like an estimate of the quantitative uncertainty or confidence of the model could be a solution, like to know how much I can trust that support that I receive.
Okay, thank you so much. I think we will conclude here. There will be all the months, all the podcasts on this session that will go a bit deeper in the different question we touched base rapidly today. Maybe just as a final point, maybe could you have one sentence and one comment each on what you would like to that neurologists let go as misconception of AI? Maybe what is for you the biggest misconception regarding clinical use of AI?
It's clear for me. So it's this notion of replacement of human specialists. So this is not the case. What we will reach is an intensified human-machine cooperation. There are nice models out, like, for example, the Kantarik systems, where the algorithms and the humans do the tasks they can solve best. So that means final decision-making is with humans, analytical processes is with algorithms.
My take-home message is that so AI is not something magic. It's something that can be comprehended also by non-technician. And in order to bring value to medicine and to avoid that we have this gap between research and clinical application, we need to overcome this idea of something magic or non-comprehensible, but we need like to work together to ensure that these solutions are developed in a collaborative manner that is useful also for end users of the solutions.
Okay, thank you so much. And thank you again for your comments. And we will have other opportunity to discuss that into detail.
Thank you very much for the moderation. It was a pleasure.
Thank you.
This has been EAN Cast Weekly Neurology. Thank you for listening. Be sure to follow us on Apple Podcasts, Spotify, or your preferred podcatcher for weekly updates from the European Academy of Neurology. You can also listen to this and all of our previous episodes on the EAN campus to gain points and become an EAN expert in any of our 29 neurological specialties. Simply become an EAN individual member to gain access. For more information, visit ean.org/membership. That's ean.org/membership. Thanks for listening. EAN Cast Weekly Neurology is your unbiased and independent source for educational and research-related neurological content. Although all content is provided by experts in their field, it should not be considered official medical advice.